This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ+ community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are very tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. Tell your next-door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
This is Saturday Magazine.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 at Australia's very first Pride Centre here in St Kilda.
And Australia's only LGBTQI plus radio station.
Community-owned radio station.
Almost right, 28 years.
Jeez.
Look, a couple of quick messages before we go to Misha. Thank you from 359. Lovely sentiment, Macca, about all being in it together and looking after each other. It is important to stay positive. And that was around, you know, you may not be able to see your friends, but you can certainly give them a phone call. You can certainly give them a Zoom call. You know, perhaps even, you know, make a little gift to send them because you can get it picked up. Yeah, you don't even have to take it to the post office if you use another service, because Australia Post don't do that.
Macca, our guest.
Our guest, yeah.
He's waiting, probably on the edge of their bed.
Yeah, so Misha, the most important part, Misha Ketchell from The Conversation, editor of The Conversation.
Good morning, Misha.
Where are you, Misha? Are you on the edge of the bed, kitchen table, lounge room, front yard or front porch? Where are you?
Good morning. Well, I hate to disappoint you, but I am kitchen table.
Kitchen table, that's good.
I got that wrong. I just assumed that you'd had kids running around and you might have found a bit of solace in the bedroom, but I got it wrong,
so to speak.
No, kitchen table, fortunately, and I'm sitting here with a computer, and something that you said a moment ago, Tass, actually sent me to the computer to look something up, because you uttered a sentence which I don't think I've ever heard on radio before,
which
when
is?
You said, I've got to do most of your Orify, Macca. And I had never heard Orify as the plural of orifices. I thought it was correct.
Is it correct?
And indeed, you are absolutely right. The Urban Dictionary says Orify, plural of orifice, and then it gives this sentence as an example. It was a terrific night, but the majority of my Orify are sore today.
and Mishra, I have to confess that I learnt that term when I was working at the Melbourne Sexual Health Service many years ago.
Where they deal with a lot of
orifice. So please don't ask any questions, but that's where I learned that term. It's one of those terms that I've tucked in the back in the corner of my mind and occasionally I will pull out.
So to speak. So it's just like...
Well, it was very good. It was a terrific sentence. It's sort of 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
So I'm glad that amused you. I'm glad that amused you.
Now, you know, the other night on the ABC, I don't know what program it was, but they were talking... There was a little thing about rhinoceros, and they called them rhinoceroses. It's not, it's rhinoceri is the plural. And I was screaming at the television.
Yeah.
So
that's
there you go.
Right, but then you always find that there are weird exceptions, and the ones you get wrong, like the plural of octopuses. I'm not quite sure if it's octopi or octopuses. There are always ones that are confusing. In this,
so. I think it's octopi.
What I have trouble with is when you have a number of a similar group of animals, like a school of fish or a gaggle of this or a, you know, a club of that.
Why don't you say a shitload?
Or just a loss.
What's happening in the news?
Yeah, so what's happening? Misha, let's get to the serious stuff. Let's start off. I think Australia and the US and the EU have suffered a massive failure in Afghanistan in terms of what's happening there now. But, you know, 20 years on, unfortunately, what have we achieved?
Well, it's not just what we've achieved, but it's what our failure to achieve anything terribly much has cost us. I think it's, you know, really the key question that you need to sort of focus on. There was an academic called Kevin Forster from Monash University who wrote about that in The Conversation this week. And he said, you know, the costs have been significant. 41 combat-related deaths, 260 wounded. This is just from an Australian perspective. More than 500 veteran suicides, thousands affected by post-traumatic stress disorder, around $10 billion expended. Incredible damage to our international reputation because of the war crimes, the Brereton Report. It's just an absolute utter disaster on every level.
And we've got the cost in human lives. I don't know how we actually deal with that. I mean, something like 60,000 members of the Afghan Defence Force have died in this war. The Americans have spent $200 million a day, every day, for the last 20 years. So do you think Joe Biden, in terms of him saying, well, you know, we had to get out, he's, you know, part of that narrative is Trump had made a, Trump had put the date, this is the date we're going to leave. Biden, he did have a choice. He could have said, no, we're going to stay and we're going to... But he made a decision that he wasn't going to hand this on to another president. The way that they left, and they're now blaming the Afghan political elite and the Afghan military. But it's not a simple story as that, is it, Misha? It's not as simple a story as that to, you know, to put out there.
Absolutely not. And it's interesting. I mean, Biden doesn't have a great track record in terms of foreign policy. He actually opposed the push that Obama launched, I think it would have been about 2011, somewhere around then. You know, he sort of seems to have gone into this with his mind very much made up, but very little planning, very poor execution. Even those, you know, on the Republican side of politics who, you know, very much support Donald Trump's original idea that America should withdraw from the war, say that the execution has been appalling. But there's an interesting speech, I think it's this week, by Tom Tugendhat, who is a member of the UK Parliament, who was a Conservative member of the UK Parliament, who served in Afghanistan. And he basically made this quite powerful speech where he said, let's stop talking about forever wars. Let's recognise that forever peace is bought not cheaply but hard through determination and the will to endure. And the tragedy of Afghanistan is that we are swapping that patient achievement for a second fire and a second war. And basically what he was saying was there have been instances where forces have gone into countries and have actually been able to bring about a peace, but that requires patience and persistence and a genuine commitment, which, you know, appears to have been lacking here. And it's a massive betrayal for, of course, the people who have helped Allied forces in Afghanistan. It's a massive betrayal for the Afghani people. It's a massive betrayal for the veterans. It's a disaster on every level. And
Misha, we'll need to ask you to speak closer to the microphone, if that's okay.
Sure. There was a really good column also this week by Michelle Grattan, talking about, you know, Scott Morrison's comments on this issue. And one of the things that the federal government in Australia has done that really echoes the US, he's talked about the difficulty of getting Afghan people who helped us out of the country because of issues around immigration. And you'll see in the US where you've got that real sort of white nationalist strain, the hard right of the Republican Party are basically doing the same thing. They're already saying aggressively that they don't want to resettle any Afghan refugees, which just seems like an extraordinary thing to say in the circumstances, given what people in Afghanistan have done for coalition forces.
I mean, there is... Let's go briefly to the narrative that the Afghan political leadership gave up the fight and that the Afghan military weren't prepared to fight. Now, in terms of the political leadership, the president said that he left to ensure there was less bloodshed, that there wasn't a fight. Okay, I think he left for a number of reasons. But in terms of the military, part of that narrative that they didn't fight, increasingly what's coming out is that the whole basis of the Afghan Defence Force being able to maintain control in Afghanistan was based to a large extent on the ability to have an air capability. And as the Americans pulled out, the contractors that maintained the aircraft left with them, and the Afghans weren't as heavily trained in maintaining that equipment. So there's a number of... And also there's the, you know, some pretty serious allegations about corruption in terms of the money coming into Afghanistan but not actually getting down to the troops on the ground. Do you have a perspective on that, Misha?
Well, just, I mean, I think I've probably been across some of the same things that you have, which is the Afghan military forces relied very much on US air support, in particular from the incredibly sophisticated armies of drones that they had at their disposal. And the moment that you removed those capabilities, they were very limited in what they could do. Most people who understand sort of the depths of the military and logistics, and that's not my area of expertise, but most people that understand it are saying that what happened was, far from being surprising, it was entirely foreseeable, utterly predictable, arguably inevitable.
Now, we're going to have to go to a break.
But before we do that, Macca...
There's a message I need to read out.
Well, there's a couple here, actually.
Which is from our newsreader. He says, the pedantically correct plural of octopus is octopodes. It's a Greek word, not Latin, so it takes the Greek plural form of des rather than the Latin plural form of I.
There we go.
So there you go, Tash. You should have known that.
I did know that, actually.
I had a feeling octopi was wrong, yeah.
And what about the message from Adrian Burns? Adrian says...
G'day to
you. I think this is great.
I want the plural of bus to be by.
That's very clever. Thank you, Adrian.
Yes. You are on Saturday Magazine Joy 94.9 with Macca and Tass.
Misha, keen to hear your reflections on what's occurring in New South Wales at the moment, in the way in which the Berejiklian government is leading and responding to the COVID pandemic. What are your reflections? What are your thoughts here?
I think I actually read a really great article on that this week by Bernie Keane in Crikey, where he was talking about the fact that if you contrast the New South Wales approach with Victoria, you're really looking at a difference between a neoliberal approach and interventionism. So the Victorian approach has been very strong in sort of the government role in terms of closing things down, and the New South Wales approach up until quite recently has really relied upon a market-based approach that's based on technocratic sort of ways of dealing with outbreaks, so contact tracing, those types of things. And the evidence is very clear that the market-based approach, the technocratic approach, doesn't work, hasn't worked, and you need to get very serious about the role of government. Unfortunately, I think Berejiklian's position hasn't been helped by, on the one hand, Morrison's position in the early days, which was very much sort of on the market-based approach, small government side, and on the other hand, by sections of the very strong sort of right-wing media in New South Wales, which have also advocated that sort of failed approach. So I think, you know, there's no doubt that the evidence is now been badly handled, and we're all reaping the consequences in, you know, Victoria ACT.
Messaging is so important, and giving a clear message that people understand. And let's use the example of curfews. In the last little while, you might have seen it, I think ABC have used it on a few occasions, Gladys talking about, no, look, we don't think there's any point in having curfews. No, we're not going down the curfew route. No, absolutely not. We don't see any value in it. There's no evidence. And then all of a sudden, Oh, yes. Well, we're having a curfew.
But there's no evidence to support them.
But it's mixed as to whether it works. And then, oh, she said, but so many things are mixed. And the reason she said so many things are mixed is to actually lessen the reality that she'd actually done, you know, a double reverse flip somersault to say, you know, we're now throwing everything at this, but that curfews are now coming in and mask wearing outside. And is it, I do wonder what the people of New South Wales are thinking, and particularly around curfew. Why would you have a curfew just in the areas where transmission is high? I understand why you want it there, but why wouldn't you have it everywhere else? Because what you're doing is you're creating effectively two classes of people geographically. Oh, you're the people that have got it, so we're going to, you know, put you under a curfew, but everyone else where it's still circulating, no, you're okay. I mean, I don't understand the politics. I mean, I do understand the politics of it, but I don't understand why she would do it, Misha.
Well, I think it's politics getting in the way of actually looking at the evidence. I mean, there's different levels of culpability. I mean, you can say you've adopted the wrong approach in circumstances where you don't know what the right approach is, where something's new and moving very quickly. That's one thing, right? But Barry Jiglian's behaviour has been, very recent. When, you know, Victoria's been through 5 lockdowns, and we've seen what Victoria's done, we've seen what works, we've seen how effective it is. So to actually have a model where it's been tested, where you can see it working effectively, and to ignore that, to go against that, that's ideology. That's not following the evidence.
Mm.
And I think that creates a level of culpability. And then, you know, even further, I mean, just going back to something that sort of still rankles with me, you know, the Prime Minister's sort of undermining of the Victorian approach at different stages through this process. It's one thing to be wrong. It's another thing to actually be actively undermining somebody who is getting it right and doing a good job.
He's also been missing in action of late, don't you think?
I think that's true as well. And, you know, look, it's been another bad week for the federal government in terms of, I think, its response to Afghanistan has been seen as poor and has played very poorly. I think, you know, to an extent, it's a tricky situation for the government, because the reality is that they have changed their stance.
Mm.
And I think maybe, you know, a smarter approach, and I think Josh Frydenberg sort of tried to do that, would be to sort of say the evidence is now in, we can see this is what works, this is the way we're going to go, and just sort of own that change of direction. But it seems to me that it's been almost like an attempt to pretend that there hasn't been any sort of response to the evidence that's come in.
And again, you know, when you watch the different press conferences, whether it's Victoria and New South Wales, I watched the New South Wales one, and seeing, you know, the Premier getting quite defensive with journalists, you know, saying to them to wait their turn, it's not your press conference. And then when she's over it, she says, oh, thank you, and walks off. Like, doesn't actually, and in a number of occasions, actually just doesn't answer the questions. And the Prime Minister does the same thing. He doesn't answer, you know, he's, oh, well, you know, I don't agree with the premise of your question or whatever. And, you know, he and Gladys have the same thing in common. If they were paid by the word, they'd be paid a lot. The problem is a lot of the words they're saying are worthless.
So a lot of words, not a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that I've observed Berejiklian do is really blame individuals, blame the community.
Yes.
And it's this constant attacking the community and saying, you must do this, you know, you must do this, please,
and then
please,
she goes,
please,
no, she goes,
you must
please.
Do this. Well,
she does.
Well, yes, perhaps, but the point is that rather than talking about our collective responsibility as a community, how we can all work together, it's a bit of a big stick approach over the individual, and it is sort of an individualistic approach rather than a leadership community-based approach. That's my observation.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, I think Andrews has actually got that bit pretty right, in that I hear him constantly talking about the choices we make now will lead to the consequences down the track that we all have to live with. And that puts responsibility on us individually and collectively. but without undue singling out or blame. And I think that's really quite subtle but important messaging. There was a really good article written this week by Julie Zagel about the response within the Jewish community about that event.
Yes.
I think it was maybe the middle of last week, where there was an engagement being celebrated and there was a gathering. And she was talking about the sense of shame within the Jewish community that was experienced, but also the some of the anti-Semitism that came out around that particular issue. And I think at the end of the day, just taking the whole thing to the level of, we're all people, we all make individual decisions, some of us are going to make mistakes, some of us, you know, either do the wrong thing, and we should be held accountable for that. But it's not about the particular community group you're from. It's not about your background, you know. It's happening to everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And we need to be aware of the consequences of our decisions. I think that messaging that Dan Andrews has had has been really responsible. I think it's been exactly perfectly pitched. And if it was pitched the wrong way, it could encourage people to be quite malicious or vindictive or persecute people for their mistakes, which would be very counterproductive. So I think that's really important to get that right. And it's been good in Victoria and I think less so in New South Wales.
Now, we've got a message here from Daryl with 1R, and he's actually using a term that I've used, which is Glad wrap is not a protection for COVID. That what they've done in Sydney has been too little, too late. It appears as though, you know, there's effective measures in place, but the reality is when you have the amount of the infection that you have and the momentum that that causes, it is very difficult. And what the Victorian Premier is saying, you know, what he said yesterday, unless we actually get on top of this, we're very quickly going to be in the situation of Sydney. Because once you get that momentum of a large number of cases, it's the infection rate that, you know, I think New South Wales is currently around 1.4 tests, needs to be well under one to get it under control. So there's a big difference. I think, Misha, what we're seeing is not only are we fatigued, but the political leadership and, you know, the health bureaucracy and everything else is fatigued. And we need to understand that this isn't going to end tomorrow. This is going to go on for a very, very long time. So we need to put our minds to, well, it's not about living with COVID. I think living for COVID is code for dying from COVID. But it's actually how do we continue to to stay in front of this in everything that we do, whether it's the benefits, you know, the support that businesses and individuals are getting, whether it's the vaccination rollout and all of those things, it's how do we actually stay in front of this? Because I think that's the challenge we're going to face for the next few years.
That's a comment maker.
So, well,
Misha, any final responses or reflections from yourself? I think we've lost Misha.
No, we've lost him.
I don't know what's happened there.
It was such a, he actually just, you know, he could say nothing to that.
And we've got no idea how to actually call him back, do we, Maka?
No. So, so we've
I was going to actually make another comment, and I was interested in Misha's reflection, but we've lost him.
So
I haven't seen very much positive analysis of the federal government's performance of late in the media. Do you share that observation, Mac, or am I just reading in a bubble?
I'm actually looking for some, but I haven't been able to find it. I do get a bit tired of just reading all the negative.
Yeah.
I look for something positive, and it's actually hard to find it. But it's actually hard, you know, again, this is where we actually need to put our minds to how are we going to stay in front of this in a mental health sense, in a community sense. And again, it's by, you know, working together and understanding that we're all doing it tough in different ways.
You've been listening to Saturday Magazine on Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.